we're going to fix that technical problem.
Tick-tock, it's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC.
NBC.
CBS.
CNN.
Fox News. Breaking news.
Faking news. The media war. It's time to get sore.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Friday, April 8th, 2016.
Insanity while keeping up with the war.
Worked at ABC News, worked at CNN. To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of
that is the voice of my late friend Danny Schechter, the news dissector who entertained listeners in Boston, worked in network television, and formed MediaVision, it was called, a conglomerate based in New York with his partner, Rory O'Connor. Danny passed away last year, and that is a thing called Media Wars from a CD that he put out back in about 2003. And we have media wars amplifying the political wars these days, and the networks and the corporate print media are really diving in and engaging in partisan politics in ways that I find really troubling. Let's start with Paul Krugman and his column on the op-ed page of the New York Times today. I know Krugman a little bit. I've talked to him four or five times, and I find him to be a rational, reasonable guy. But these days, he is spouting the talking points and the spin of the Clinton campaign machine. And today, his headline reads, "Sanders Over the Edge." And he says in part that Bernie is becoming a Bernie bro. And Bernie bro is this way of putting down activists who support Sanders. Some of them say Sanders or bust. Some of them are a little bit extreme. But there are similar partisans for every candidate. And so to single out Bernie and to tag him with the bros is an interesting kind of smear. And it comes from the Clinton campaign. This is my point, that Krugman is echoing the talking points that are being promoted by the Clinton campaign and its range of surrogates and media outlets, including some that are captive, like Blue Nation Review, that we have outed before. So Krugman goes after Sanders, who says he wants to break up the big banks. And he writes, "Predatory lending was largely carried out by smaller non-Wall Street institutions like Countrywide Financial. The crisis itself was centered not on big banks, but on shadow banks." Now, I respectfully disagree with the Nobel Prize-winning economist who teaches at Princeton, because the mortgages that were sold by Countrywide were wrapped up into these mortgage-backed securities, and then they were traded by Wall Street banks, including Goldman Sachs and all of the big boys. So this is disingenuous and, frankly, intellectually dishonest on the part of Professor Krugman. Quoting again, "Yet going on about big banks is pretty much all Sanders has done. On the rare occasions on which he has been asked for more detail, he didn't seem to have anything more to offer. And this absence of substance beyond the slogans seems to be true of his positions across the board." Now, this is flatly untrue as well. Because Sanders, from the beginning, when he started talk about free public college and universities, he talked about exactly how he would pay for it, with a tax on Wall Street transactions. He talks about how he would pay for a conversion to single-payer health care. He does have detailed plans. But those are being cast aside as the media engages in the swift boating of Bernie Sanders. And I define swift boating the way Karl Rove or those kinds of political operators would. You attack a candidate on his or her strengths. And that's exactly what they're doing to Sanders. They know that his message of breaking up the banks is extremely popular. And so they want to do everything they can to undermine it. Then, of course, Krugman feels obligated to enter into this kind of ad hominem. He says, "It's one thing for the Sanders campaign to point to Clinton's Wall Street connections, which are real, although the question should be whether they have distorted her positions, a case the campaign has never even tried to make. But recent attacks on Clinton as a tool of the fossil fuel industry are just plain dishonest." Now, I've analyzed those and talked about them. And while the amount of money that is involved is relatively small, given her overall campaign, it is significant that lobbyists who work for the fossil fuel industries are a very central part of her campaign, and not just the funding. And then Krugman unloads on this. He says, then there was Wednesday's rant about how Mrs. Clinton is not qualified to be president. What probably set that off was a recent interview of Sanders by the Daily News, in which he repeatedly seemed unable to respond when pressed to go beyond his usual slogans. Now, I unpacked the Daily News interview yesterday, and if you haven't had a chance to listen to Thursday's Peter B. Collins News and Comment podcast, please make time to do so. I read every word of the transcript of that editorial board interview with Sanders. And the confusion that is cited was interjected by the members of the editorial board. Sanders was very clear on how he would break up the banks. And he was explicit that he wasn't going to go into the boardroom at J.P. Morgan Chase and say, you got to sell this or you got to sell that. He wants the banks to do it themselves, to slim down, to get to the point that they're not too big to fail. And that is the whole point of it. And that's the other point that is easily dismissed by people like Paul Krugman. And here's one that is just bizarre. He says, and the timing of the Sanders rant was truly astonishing, given Hillary's large lead in delegates based largely on the support of African-American voters who respond to her pragmatism because history tells them to distrust extravagant promises. Now, this is amazing. And it is racist in its tone. It is condescending to African-Americans in a backhanded way, saying that they respond to pragmatism because history tells them to distrust extravagant promises. Oh, like the ones that Barack Obama made? I mean, this is really a new low for Paul Krugman. And on Facebook this morning, a friend of mine who I know is a staunch supporter of Hillary posted a link to the Washington Post editorial published today, actually published yesterday, April 7th, and she just accepted at face value the headline, which reads, Mr. Sanders' shocking ignorance on his core issue. And once again, we see attacks on Sanders that are based on the faulty analysis of his editorial board interview with the New York Daily News. So the Post editorial says, given his commitment to the message, you might expect he would have some familiarity with the policy details and implications of attacking Wall Street. And the Post, now owned by Amazon gazillionaire Jeff Bezos, offers its clear bias toward the banks. At any rate, it says the editorial board interview with the candidate proved otherwise. The senator seemed to have no idea of what reformed banks should look like or whether he would need new legislation, even though the government under his presidency would play a central role in tearing apart these complex financial institutions. Now, as I detailed yesterday, this is a completely spun-up interpretation of the exchange between Sanders and the people at the Daily News. The Post goes on, it is astonishing that, on this of all issues, the campaign would need to issue a what-the-candidate-meant-to-say statement. Even then, the campaign has left a lot of essential questions unanswered, like, what is breaking up the banks meant to accomplish? Well, Bernie made it very clear, and anybody who reads the Daily News transcript will see that he gives background and context before he answered the question. And he said that we almost crashed the economy in 2008 because banks were too big to fail, and now they're even bigger. That's what boneheads at the Washington Post, that's what motivates him to call for breaking them up. Then they go pro-bankster here. Regulators working under Dodd-Frank have gone a long way to addressing the first two issues without breaking up banks, a step that many experts warn may not be worth the costs. I mean, that just shows who they are speaking for. They're speaking for Wall Street, and they're speaking for the Clinton campaign. And when I see people who haven't read the transcript of the interview, who haven't read the real information behind Sanders' proposals, you can see what they're up to. They are spinning, they are attacking, and they're engaging a lot of people who... and this is where I'd like to use Hillary's recent comment on them, who have to get down and do a little research before they just accept things that are presented by political campaigns. Now, one of the reasons that Team Clinton is so concerned is spelled out in a new poll released here in California today. It is the highly regarded Field poll, and it shows that over the last 9 months, that Hillary Clinton's 63-point lead over Bernie Sanders has now been reduced to a single digit, 6 points, and we have 2 months to go before the critical and big delicate primary here in California. So this is a stunning gain for Bernie Sanders. It's one of the reasons why Clinton is so concerned. And the polling in New York shows that Sanders is catching up, too. I saw one yesterday that puts him within 8 points of Clinton, and again in single digits, with the crucial debate coming up next week and the primary the following Tuesday. So the surge that Sanders has hoped for is starting to develop. And while it appears he may not have the traction to win the nomination outright before the convention, he is going to be able to deny Hillary Clinton, I think, the nomination before the convention, and that puts him in a much more powerful position. There is erosion in Hillary's support from women, from Latino voters in particular, and the analysis shows that she is not growing her support. And this is one of the points I've been making all along, is that Hillary is so widely known and people have such firm opinions about her that there is very little room for growth. And Sanders still has room for growth, particularly among independents, and that's going to benefit him in the California primary, where people like me who are not members of a political party are designated as no NPP, no party preference. And the rules are that NPP voters may request a Democratic ballot, but the Republican rules don't permit NPP voters to cross over that way. So an NPP voter in California who wants to support Trump or Cruz has to re-register. But somebody like me, I just go to the polls and ask for a Democratic ballot. So that's a huge advantage for Bernie Sanders in California. As Paul Krugman noted in his attack on Sanders, Hillary Clinton's early victories have been fueled by healthy support from African-American voters. And yesterday in Philadelphia, Bill Clinton risked unraveling some of that support from black Americans, particularly as it relates to the Black Lives Matter movement and the draconian laws that Bill Clinton signed into effect when he was president back in the 1990s. And as you hear Black Lives Matter's protesters interrupt Clinton.
Now you're screaming. So let's do another one. Whoa. No, wait. I want to deal with them all. Come on.
So he's referring to some placards the protesters have that deplore Hillary Clinton's use of the term super predators to describe black criminals back in the 1990s.
This is what's the matter. I don't know how you would characterize the gang leaders who got 13-year-old kids hopped up on crack and sent them out onto the street to murder other African-American children. Maybe you thought they were good citizens. She didn't. You are defending the people who kill the lives you say matter. Tell the truth.
Now, Bill Clinton's voice is cracking. He is red in the face.
And
he has really lost control in this setting in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia. And it's interesting, this video was first released by the Weekly Standard, Bill Kristol's right-wing weekly magazine. And this phrase all revolves around the use of the term super predators that Hillary used during this crack and crime wave back in the 90s, and the Bill Clinton response was 100,000 new cops, expansion of the death penalty, and mass incarceration. And Hillary launched her campaign by trying to apologize and separate herself from those policies. And I think Bill Clinton did a lot of damage in his little exchange with the protesters in Philly yesterday. And I'm linking in the show file to this podcast to a piece I picked up on the web from a news blog called The News American, and it is entitled A Short History of Clintons and Racism. And it's pretty neutral. You can see the recap of events, and it does make you wonder why so many African Americans are so loyal to both Bill and Hillary Clinton. The former Secretary of State laughed off on the Today Show this morning what she calls Republican fantasies, that she will be indicted and facing charges over her use of the private server and the handling of classified information while she was at the State Department. She said that Republicans who believe that she'll be indicted over the email scandal, quote, live in that world of fantasy and hope because they have a mess on their hands. She dismissed the fantasy, as she calls it, as both false and ridiculous. That's not going to happen. There's not even the remotest chance that's going to happen. Well, Jonathan Turley, the respected law professor at George Washington University in D.C., runs a blog, and he published today an important series of questions. Actually, this came up on April 3rd. And I want to thank Linda Lewis, a very smart and resourceful listener, who sent me a link to this. And what he points out is that Hillary's top staff people, Cheryl Mills, who was her chief of staff, Jake Sullivan, the deputy chief, the assistant to Mills named Heather Samuelson, and her State Department spokesperson, Philippe Raines. And let's stipulate here just a quick fact. Philippe Raines resisted disclosure of his emails for months and months and months, and the State Department said they didn't have any. And then they released thousands of pages of his emails. So just consider that these four people have different recollections of what went on, yet they are going to be represented by a single attorney, and her name is Beth Wilkinson. And this is an unusual arrangement, as Turley points out, because the joint representation is likely to reassure the Clinton legal team, but it is a curious choice for the individual clients in an investigation that covers a large number of emails and actions taken over a long period of time. They could have serious potential conflicts of interest in the mishandling of classified evidence or the circumvention of security protocols and rules. There is little reason why all four would prefer the same counsel unless they wanted to present a uniform account. Generally, it is clearly to a person's advantage to have a single lawyer who is solely and exclusively pursuing your own interest. There is little question that the Clinton campaign would prefer key witnesses to be represented jointly because it gives them more control over the evidence and the testimony that is going to be surfaced here. So, take a look at this, and he also publishes the rules of conflict of interest that start with, a lawyer shall not advance two or more adverse positions in the same matter. A lawyer shall not represent a client with respect to a matter if such representation is likely or will be adversely affected by representation of another client. Curious. Also, yesterday in USA Today, a man who I assume is a Republican lawyer, he spent 25 years at the Justice Department, and he teaches law at the George H.W. Bush School of Government at Texas A&M. His name is Ronald Sievert, and he wrote a piece saying that the classified smokescreen hides what he considers to be the real crime. The Clinton campaign has attempted to make the public believe she's not guilty of anything because the information on her very unprotected server was not marked as classified. But the applicable law, which he cites, doesn't even mention the word classified once. Its focus is on information respecting the national defense. So his argument is that the statute is broad enough that her claims that nothing that she sent or received was classified at the time is irrelevant. So it's an interesting argument. I've linked to it so you can read it. He does conclude, regardless, I am not confident that the Justice Department will indict. So that remains to be seen. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like the fabulous Grant Gibson in Portland and the incredible Faith Peoples, who has multiple subscriptions. There's Terry Paris in Berkeley, and Willem Gruters in the Netherlands has just renewed his annual subscription. He is a frequent correspondent to yours truly and often comes up with some very interesting items. Willem, I appreciate your support. And I want to invite others to join in. You know I need it. I don't even make minimum wage here doing the Peter B. Collins podcast. And we do have expenses, phone calls and phone lines and my webmaster and all these things. So I would appreciate your help. Sign on to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button and then the tab Become a Subscriber. And new annual subscribers who take out the $50 level and supply a mailing address in the continental U.S., we'll get my bonus gift. There are three book titles you can choose from, and they're listed on the subscriber page at peterbcollins.com. Yesterday, the Chicago Tribune published an editorial praising the Chicago Tribune for its exhaustive coverage of the Dennis Hastert sexual abuse cases. Now, to its credit, the Tribune has confirmed that at least four young men were sexually abused by Dennis Hastert before he entered politics, when he was the wrestling coach at a high school in suburban Chicago. And his sentencing is coming up at the end of this month. He has pled guilty to lying to the FBI and structuring hush money payments to the man who is still known only as Individual A. Now, as I've told you over and over again, there is so much more to this story, and the corporate media won't touch it. Sybelle Edmonds, to her credit, has detailed the corruption of Dennis Hastert, his compromise by Turkish agents, his involvement in many scandalous schemes. It's all footnoted, carefully reported, and you can find it on the homepage at boilingfrogspost.com, if you can stomach the full story of the sordid Dennis Hastert. Well, Pope Francis issued his long-awaited encyclical called Amoris Laetitia, or The Joy of Love, and it changes the tone, much as Francis has done in many ways, but it doesn't change the rules of the Catholic Church. And so there's no change on same-sex marriage, on the ordination of women, or other contentious issues that have divided the Catholic Church. But the Pope makes a number of important statements, and my friend Tom Rees, the Jesuit priest who is an accomplished journalist, has written a lengthy review of it, and he is delighted, as a Catholic with many parts of it. But the exhortation that says every person, regardless of sexual orientation, should be treated with respect and consideration, while every sign of unjust discrimination is to be carefully avoided, particularly any form of aggression and violence. But in the very next section, he states categorically that the Church cannot support same-sex marriage or unions. There are absolutely no grounds for considering homosexual unions to be in any way similar, remotely analogous to God's plan for marriage and family. Now, the same Pope has invited Bernie Sanders to come to the Vatican late next week and give a speech about economic, social, and environmental justice. Now, to be clear, the Pope himself didn't extend this invitation, but I'm sure he approved it. It came from the Pontifical Academy of Sciences. And just ahead of the New York primary, and there are quite a few Catholics in New York, Bernie's going to go to the Vatican. Sanders said, "I'm delighted to have been invited by the Vatican to a meeting on restoring social justice and environmental sustainability to the world economy. Francis has made clear that we must overcome the globalization of indifference in order to reduce economic inequalities, stop financial corruption, and protect the natural environment." So, he went out of his way to say he disagrees with the Pope on women's rights, gay rights, but he admires him for speaking up about income equality and making it a moral issue. I have some good news. For years now, I have been hectoring one Barack Obama that he has the power, with the stroke of his pen, to reschedule, reclassify marijuana in the Drug Enforcement Act scheme down from Schedule 1, which puts it up with meth and heroin and LSD. And in a letter to Senator Elizabeth Warren. The Drug Enforcement Administration has said that it could complete this reclassification in the first half of this year. That's just a couple of months. The agency slipped the news into a letter to Senator Elizabeth Warren, who had asked for more information on marijuana scheduling and about limits on medical marijuana research. The letter also said the FDA has concluded a review of the safety of marijuana and its recommendation has been sent to the DEA, but we don't know the contents of that letter or the nature of the recommendation. So this is very interesting. Hillary Clinton has been prodded by Bernie Sanders, and she says, well, marijuana should be downgraded from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2. And Sanders says we need to simply remove it from this list entirely. And I fully agree with Mr. Sanders on this issue. Over at the Trump campaign, they are learning that the Koch brothers have basically thrown up their hands about the presidential race this year. They're sitting on that $900 million that they collected from all the fat cats, and they can't find a horse to place it on. So they are shifting their money into the Republican Senate races, trying to prop up, for example, Ron Johnson in Wisconsin. They popped $1 million to support him against Russ Feingold, the former senator, who is coming back, and the polls show that he is ahead of Johnson at this point. They've also put money, $2 million, into trying to defeat the Democrat Ted Strickland in Ohio, who is challenging Rob Portman. Strickland is an interesting guy. He served in the House. He's kind of a moderate Democrat. I think he's a minister. And he served as governor, termed out, and now he is trying to advance to the Senate. And so we see that the Republicans have shifted their goals and their focuses, and, of course, Trump could create a route for Republicans that would lead to a shift in control of the Senate and a reduction in the Republican majority in the House. You remember that the FBI director, James Comey, said when he demanded that Apple unlock the San Bernardino iPhone that his request was limited to one time, one phone. Well, that was a lie, because the Justice Department is pursuing an iPhone in a case against a methamphetamine ring in Brooklyn. And they have run into a judge who is so pro-Apple that I can't believe that they're, you know, trying to continue on this case. They could, you know, suffer a big setback that, you know, would be a real surprise to them. But the FBI has, you know, pursued this. They're saying their application isn't moot and they require Apple's assistance. But James Orenstein is the magistrate in this federal courtroom in Brooklyn, and he issued a ruling back in late February where he said the FBI could not compel Apple to unlock that phone. What the government could not achieve in Congress, the judge said, it cannot now get from the courts. And he said it's also clear that the government has made the considered decision that it's better off securing such crypto legislative authority from the courts rather than taking the chance that open legislative debate might produce a result less to its liking. And Orenstein also agreed with Apple's contention that the government wanted that what the government wanted in the Brooklyn case was too much of a burden on the company. So I think that's interesting, and I hope that Orenstein issues them a stunning setback. You ever heard of Max Boot? Max Boot is considered a leading light by America's neocons. He helped steer us into the war in Iraq, and he's published a piece at Commentary Magazine that I just got wind of today, and he's exposing the Obama administration for the way it is playing fast and loose with the number of troops that have been deployed to Iraq. And Max Boot goes into some length here to expose that the official story is that we're supposed to have about 3,870 armed troops in Iraq, but the real figure, he believes, is around 5,000. And he says, apparently, President Obama has quietly decided to ramp up the U.S. commitment against ISIS by relaxing the rules limiting how many U.S. personnel can be in Iraq and what they can do. And Boot says, that's a good thing. Well, thanks for explaining this, Max, but I think you're full of shit. And I don't think that increasing our troop levels and getting re-involved in a ground war in Iraq and Syria is a good idea. But of course, you can't understand that because you're so committed to the old Bush plan. And he goes out of his way to ding Obama for withdrawing troops, according to the Bush exit plan, back in 2011. That's a very popular Republican talking point. The Syrian government has released an American freelance photojournalist who was captured almost 4 years ago. He's from San Diego, 33-year-old Kevin Patrick Dawes, D-A-W-E-S, and he was handed off to Russian authorities, and I guess he gets to wind his way back to the good old U.S. of A. Also, speaking of Syria, and consider the source here, this is from RT, the Russian media outlet that operates in the United States, but it cites a man named Doug Laux, L-A-U-X, a former CIA operative who's got a new book coming out. And Laux told NBC that the White House and CIA leaders had made it clear from the beginning that the goal of our task force was to find ways to remove President Assad from office. Now, the book is coming out soon. It's heavily redacted, and he is not permitted to disclose the details of the plan. I guess he claims authorship of it. Laux has claimed that his ideas gained traction in Washington, were approved by David Petraeus, who was CIA director at the time, and it included both bolstering Syrian rebels and pressuring and paying senior members of Assad's regime to push him out. So we see that Barack Obama has operated with great secrecy, and Max Boot finds it worthwhile when it advances his aims. But the bottom line here is that we are enduring mission creep here in the lame duck year of the Obama presidency, and most people are oblivious to it. I will continue to hammer away at this because I think it's very important. Whoever becomes president next January is going to inherit this ungodly mess, and Obama's got a lot of explaining to do. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. There are many stories I didn't get to. I wish I could. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.